With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Right, well, my next guest is a guy who I saw on Twitter. I thought, yeah, I think I could get on quite well with this guy. And after chasing you around, Darren, for what feels like 4 weeks just missing each other, I feel like I've come to know you quite well now.
Yeah, well, I've bottomed down a little bit on the Twitter since that day. But yeah, it's taken a while to get sorted, but we're here.
Yeah, now tell me, what was going on that day? You seem to be quite charged about it. Was it the European Cup that you were about to play?
No, it was the Prem Cup. It was a long week. It was a week where the coaches made it pretty obvious that the group of us that were playing in that semi-final, which had been hyped up in the local media of the first time Worcester played in a semi-final, competitive semi-final, forever, I think it was. But it was made quite clear to the group of us during the week that we weren't the guys that would be playing the following week, which I think was the Harlequins Prem game. So straight away, as a group, we're pretty annoyed. Obviously, the Prem is the big one. It's the one that everyone wants to play in. And like I said, we were told dead straight that this group of players, apart from the, I think there were three guys that played for us on that day, on that Friday night against Saris, that were dead certs for the following week for Harlequins. But the rest of us, we thought this might be a game that we're fighting for a place in the team. It wasn't to be. And then once the team got announced, reading the comments about the team selection, you sort of read some pretty harsh comments about how we were going to lose a game. It was a game that we wanted to win, but with the team we were putting out, we were going to lose. So I think for me personally, it all sort of boiled over and resulted in that tweet.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, you know, because yeah, I've been doing this podcasting malarkey for about 4 years now, and I can see both sides of it. I mean, first of all, I can see the fan side, because I used to post all sorts of stupid things on Twitter, because I don't think you realise that there's actually another person on the other side of that. You know, you think, big, burly rugby player, probably used to loads of criticism, so on and so forth. It's just not really the case. You know, there is someone on the other side of it, and sometimes these things do sting.
Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, big, burly professionals used to criticism. You certainly expect it from coaches. I've got a brother who's not shy on criticising me after a performance, so we are used to it. We're used to kind of, like, you know, hearing it from people we respect and we want to hear it from. But when you sort of think, well, actually, there's a group of us that are a bit, you know, for want of a better phrase, a bit pissed off that we've already been told we're not looked in for selection the following week. As a group, we sort of said to each other, well, do you know what? Let's just give this a good crack. Saris were obviously not going to bring their out-and-out first team, although whichever team they bring, third or fourth string is going to be pretty decent. So we knew we were going to be up against a good Saris team, and thought, you know what, let's just give it a best shot. The likelihood is, if we did get to the final, it may not even be the same group of players playing in that final. So let's just give it a good shot. And on the day, we actually performed pretty well. I think statistically, we were probably the better team, and we certainly had more carries and more possession and territory. It was just on the day we didn't manage to finish. But like I said, it doesn't matter who reads the comments, whether you're a 14-year-old kid or whether you're a 34-year-old professional. If someone's criticising, you still take it sometimes a little bit too much to heart, but other times you can sort of brush it off easily. That wasn't one of those occasions where I could brush it off, and I know there was a group of other lads in the change room that felt the same.
Yeah, well, I gotta say, I did quite enjoy you letting them have it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, you know, the supporters have got their fans forum, and I've learned pretty quickly never to read a fans forum because the moment you type your name in,
oh god, no, don't do that.
Yeah, if you're expecting any compliments, I wouldn't bother. But I think professionals, we get taught in the media how to answer questions from the local newspapers and, you know, local media outlets that come in and want to have a chat to you, and you get given the same boring answers when really sometimes as a rugby player you just want to scream in their face and tell them that actually that's not what I believe and that's not what I agree with. And so social media sometimes can be that way that we can just sort of argue back, as it were, and if the fans feel that they, you know, don't like the team that the coaches have picked, at least the players can have a way of, you know, like, you know, going back at them and saying, do you know what, Laura? Your supporters support us, and whatever happens at the end of the game, at least you know we've given 110%.
It is tough, and I think it's also tough in the situation that Worcester are in too, because, you know, you look at those team sheets, they don't tend to change too much. You know, for a lot of fans, I guess they're looking at the team sheet they see in the Premiership week in, week out, and because it doesn't change for them, you know, a lot of these lads that they're seeing playing on that weekend, they're just not the same boys.
No, exactly, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think that's a frustration amongst that group of players who played in that Saris game, is that the Premiership team doesn't change, barring injuries. Most of the time, it's the same 15, and then the rest of us are sort of scrapping out for places on the bench, which over the last sort of block of three Prem games haven't really changed, again, apart from injuries. So you're sort of thinking, well, if form's not going to get me in the team, what is? And that frustration does boil over, But the way that we can show our frustration and show our potential is by those cup games. And obviously we've got a European game coming up in the future. But at the time, that semi-final was a great, great way for some of us that haven't been playing in the Premiership team recently to go out there and showcase what we've got in front of the coaches. And also some of the younger guys that maybe some of the supporters have heard of but haven't seen play a lot. But, you know, obviously working day in, day out with them, you know how good they are. And
yeah.
You know, they're good enough to be in the Premiership team as well. So, you know, like I said, when you read those comments and you know how good the players playing around you are and how much they've worked hard in training to get a place in the team, it's frustrating to see that the supporters want the big names in those games. When sometimes it's not the big names who are playing the best rugby, it's the little guys that nobody knows of that are maybe training the hardest and playing the best. But unfortunately, because of the way the team's selected, they don't get a chance.
Yeah, it's so tough though, because, you know, big name players are big name players for a reason, I guess.
Yeah.
But people need opportunity. You know, opportunity is just as important as talent. If you don't get the opportunity to start with, you'll frankly just never know.
Well, that's it. I think back at all the guys that I've had the opportunity. Ted Hill, for example, is probably the best one from our club over the recent season. He only got the opportunity because of injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, the likelihood is if there wasn't injuries in the back row at the time that Ted Hill was playing, he may have not played in that Leicester game and come off the bench to score two winning tries. And that would have led to him not getting an England call-up. The point is, he got a chance and he took it, and rightly so, he's a class player, and that's why he's stuck in the first team ever since, and hence why he's got his England cap. But it is about taking those opportunities, and sometimes it is an injury, and sometimes it's a lack of form. If somebody in your position is not playing well enough, then there has to, you know, I personally feel there has to be a rotation where the next guy comes in, and if he plays well, he sticks in that position, and until he starts playing badly or somebody else is playing well in those sort of cup games or in the Premier League game or the A-League games, then, you know, that rotation comes through and that creates a healthy, competitive environment. Team sort of stays the same every week, you can get a bit stale.
I see the point of what the coaches are doing here, because, well, okay, have you ever heard of that law on Twitter, which is if an argument goes on in Twitter long enough, you'll eventually end up with Hitler?
No, I've not.
Right.
That sounds good.
So if I listen to anyone talk about rugby for too long, it always results in talking about Ben Darwin. Ben Darwin's this sports psychology guy who, frankly, I listen to everything he says. And one of the things that he talks about is the importance of a settled squad, settled combinations, you know, the combination between the second row and the hooker and how that develops. So when you first say that, I'm thinking, I kind of see the point with the coaches. But on the other hand, rugby is so attritional that you actually need to make sure you've got the strength in depth and other combinations coming through. And also, I don't know how you then go about spotting the next generation or that next person. And not to mention, how do you make training competitive?
Well, that's it. I mean, that's what I've struggled with. I understand if something's working well, then, you know, you keep it. And we go through pre-season games at the start of the season so that combinations have a bit of an opportunity to get used to each other leading into the first block of prem games. But I think sort of post-Christmas, it is almost a free-for-all. If things are working, yeah, by all means, stick to it. Obviously, if you're 9 and 10 are working well together, you're 10 and 12 are communicating well together and things are flying, then, you know, you stick with it and what have you. But without the rotation, from past experiences, without that rotation, people get complacent. People who aren't involved start to not give up, because we're paid good money to not give up. But you start to think, well, there's only so many times I can keep knocking on the coach's door and asking why I'm not in the team or what I need to do to improve before you get given the same answers every week and you realise it's not going to make any difference. So.
Yeah.
I think sort of, you know, the odd little tweak here and there keeps everyone on their toes. Certainly the guys in the starting lineup, you know, if they feel that they're two bad performances away from being dropped, you know, all of a sudden their performances start to improve. And the same for the guys that are on the bench or fighting for a place on the bench. If you give them the carrot that, you know, there's an opportunity, a genuine opportunity, because I think we've all been told there's an opportunity and we all know it's not. But if you've got that genuine opportunity to work your way back into the team, I think your training levels will improve because, you know, the coaches are keeping an eye on how you're training. And if every individual's training improves, then all of a sudden as a squad, as a group, you start to push each other. And that's sort of the frustration in terms of being a member of that group just outside of the first team at the moment, is that we want competition. We want to be pushing for that first team and have a genuine chance. If we're not good enough, we're not good enough. By all means, let the coaches tell us we're not good enough. It's fine. I'm big enough and ugly enough to take that on the chin. But, you know, when you've got something to work towards, you want to know that there's definitely something there.
It raises really interesting squad composition questions. I was chatting to a guy the other day who, you know, being blunt about it, and actually, you know, this was a conversation. He knows he is second choice. In fact, he knows that his job is to show up every day, be professional and be ready in case the first choice goes down. And he's comfortable with that. And although I kind of admire the professionalism to do that, I also think, how many of those guys do I want in my squad? Because on the other hand, you want the guy who desperately wants that starting job rather than the guy who's just willing to settle for, you know, that second, you know, like the backup quarterback. I don't think that's always the best mindset.
Well, you nailed it on the head a minute ago when you said, you know, rugby is attritional. At the end of the day, somebody could go down and be out for the rest of the season, and that second choice has to step up and has to be your first choice for the rest of the season. Now, if he, you know, I don't obviously know who that guy is, but if you know your second choice and you know that for the rest of the season, are you really going to be pushing yourself in training to improve on what you need to improve on? Or just happy to be there waiting for that 20-25 minutes off the bench on a Saturday? It's difficult. Coaches, obviously, well, I think most coaches will have a first, second, third, fourth choice in their mind in every position. But there has to be a time where that overlaps and all of a sudden, yeah, you might be second choice, but actually this week you're first because the guy in front of you is not playing well enough and you've got to be ready for it, haven't you, really?
Yeah. Now, just taking the conversation off in a slightly different way here, I'm quite interested in, you know, your progression through rugby, because reading up about your career, you know, you seem to have done things pretty much the hard way around.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I was part of the Bristol Academy when I went to college, which was Filton College.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Which is now South Gloucestershire, which I think was the hold-up you guys had a few weeks back.
Yeah.
But I started there and I captained them in my final year. I thought that I was sort of a shoo-in for an academy contract at Bristol, which didn't work out. So I actually went and got a part-time job at JJB, of all places, just making sure it was sports-specific. and trained part-time with Bristol, who were in the Premiership at the time, but I was obviously nowhere near that sort of level. I was still in 18 straight out of college. So, yeah, part-time at Bristol, managed to earn myself a contract with them at the end of that season to be full-time, and then sort of the following season broke into the first team when they were in the Championship. And then 2 years later, when my contracts expired, went down to Cornwall for 3 years, which I think was probably the best move I've ever made, to be honest. It sort of forced me out of home. I think I would have been sort of 28, 29, still living at home if I had it my way. But forced me out of home, which made me grow up off the pitch. And it also gave me a lot of responsibility on it as well. At the time, it was a small squad down there at Pirates. They'd lost a lot of guys that previous season to the Premiership. So they're in that rebuilding phase. It was good 3 years down then, and this is now my fourth year, so I've had to sort of yo-yo a little bit down to come back up, but sort of it all makes it worthwhile, especially when you're working at a club like Worcester and the facilities we've got here sort of puts everything else into a bit of perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely find the guys who have been in the Championship appreciate what they've got a lot more. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure you'd like to have gone to the Saracens Academy, made it to the first team and just sailed through and become a property millionaire. But, I look at the clubs that you've been at, like that Bristol team. I assume, like, was that the time when, I'm guessing, Nathan Budgett's around that era, Lee Robinson?
Yeah, so that Prem year that I was part-time, you had the guys before they all sort of left when they got relegated, but you had Dan Ward-Smith.
That's right, yeah.
Sean Perry was there, Nathan Budgett, Roy Winters, who was probably my sort of idol growing up, or certainly coming through the system down at Bristol. He was a fantastic, fantastic leader and a great role model. And then, Mariano Sambucetti and that sort of, I think Rob Sidoli was also at Bristol in that premier as well. So there was a lot of guys to learn off of, a lot of strong characters as well, I think. Couple of seasons before that relegation, Bristol finished third, I think it was, and that squad then was pretty much built around those individuals and the experience that they brought to the squad. Unfortunately, I think age caught up with some, and rugby just sort of disappeared off the radar a little bit at Bristol at that time, and relegation followed. But the following season, I managed to sort of pick my head in the first team a little bit, which was good.
Yeah, Dan Ward-Smith is one of the like great players of English rugby.
Yeah, the guy was an absolute freak of an athlete. I remember seeing him with his top off and just thinking, if I ever look like that one day, I'd wear a top again. Yeah. He was just, if you thought of what a modern day rugby player should look like, that was it. I think he had a knee injury which sort of held him back a little bit, and he obviously moved on to Wasps as well. But in terms of just absolute athlete, I don't think I've come across a better one.
That was awesome. Yeah, again, another interesting story. I think it came from like Plymouth or somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think Bristol, when they first got promoted, can't remember what year it was, but when they got promoted under Richard Hill, they sort of seemed to sign a lot of Championship-based players. You had Lee Robinson, I think it was Plymouth as well. The Arscott brothers both came from Plymouth.
That's right, yeah.
Sean Perry came from Coventry. So I think they really built it around, as you said, guys that have had it hard, have had to come through the hard way, haven't had the luxury of, nice academies where you get looked after really well. They've had to sort of go out and earn their bread and make sure that they're tough enough that when they got the opportunity that they can take it. And that's I think that's probably why they did pretty well in those couple of years that they were back in the Prem, and why they finished so strongly that season. I think they came through.
Yeah, because they got into the playoffs.
I'm sure they were, I think they finished third overall and just lost in the semi-final of the playoffs. If I'm right, Roy Winters got Player of the Year, Premiership Player of the Year as well. So yeah, it was a pretty massive season for Bristol that year. I think that was the year that they had that 18 phases before the drop goal against Gloucester.
Yeah, an interesting little factoid for you. You probably already know this. Sean Perry made his England debut that year, and he made his England debut as England vice captain.
As England vice captain, there you go.
There you go. Little factoid. Now, the thing which I found really interesting, or a club I found really interesting, is Cornish Pirates and what goes on down there, because it just feels like they are ready for an expansion into the big time. It feels like they've got the sort of support base. And if they haven't, they've certainly got a very passionate support base.
Yeah. I don't think they've got a huge support base in numbers, but I think, I know for a fact that in a lot of the away games that we would play, bearing in mind it's 3 hours to Bristol, anything north of Bristol, you know, you're looking at an extra 3 or 4 hours for games like Doncaster and Nottingham. We would always have a dozen supporters, 20 supporters, which, you know, for Cornwall, is a lot of away support, really, because it's a long way. It's 7 hours in the car, 7 hours worth of petrol, 14 hours worth of petrol, accommodation, and all of a sudden it all adds up. So, yeah, there's certainly the support down there, and I think there's a little factoid for you. There's more football teams in Cornwall than rugby teams, but I think rugby is definitely the biggest sport down there. It's the one that everyone wants to do well at, and I really hope for Cornwall and for Pirates' sake that they get this stadium built in the next few years and can do something like what Exeter have done and get a team together, which I know Gavin Paves, the coaches down there, are dead set on getting a good group of guys on decent contracts and hopefully in a few years' time give it a push for promotion if obviously the league hasn't been closed off for them by then.
Yeah, now, I'm going to apologise to my listeners because I always ask this question of anyone who's ever played at Cornish Pirates. Did you play with Alan Paver? And can you tell me a little bit about Alan Paver?
I played with Alan. He was great. He was I think it was my second year that he had his testimonial, which was very well deserved for him. He'd been there for so long and dug in some dark times for Pirates, and obviously he was a hell of a player as well, and by all accounts he's a great coach now as well. So how much of a legend he is and how everyone sort of around the championship scene knows about him, has heard about him, and what a character he actually is.
Yeah, I mean, that's my basic test to find out how much of a rugby fan someone is. I ask him, do you remember Alan Paver playing? And if they say who, I was like, all right, okay.
If they know anything about the championship, though, then they all know a lot about Paves and definitely the heard of him in a few stories, I'm sure.
Yeah. So how did you find your time down in Cornish Pirates? How does it differ to being a Premiership professional?
Oh, well, in terms of facilities, I mean, it's chalk and cheese. What you get at a professional club is nothing. I say professional. Pirates are professional, but a Premiership club is nothing in comparison to down at Pirates. The gym was barely big enough for, I'd say, six lads. We had to sort of do it in rotations, backs and forwards would split up into groups. And then I think it was four at a time, the forwards would sort of feed in. You'd do your first few exercises and then the next group of four would feed in as you're sort of finishing off and coming out. It was mad. There's a squash court down there that the boys do their stretching in, and they had no such thing as foam rollers. We had fizzy drink bottles filled with water because the club couldn't afford foam rollers. So it was. If you go from a professional environment down to that, it's a massive wake up call. Having said that, what it teaches you is just to grind it out, because you don't want to stay. With all due respect to Pirates, they know that they've got players that don't want to be there for their whole career. They want to go and taste the Premiership. They want to go and taste good facilities. And what it does is it makes you hungry to train, to get out of that league, basically, and play yourself out of that league those facilities into a team that, got good stuff and playing at a good level as well.
Did you play in their playoff appearance when they lost to Bristol? No, London Welsh. London Welsh, they lost. No, they beat Bristol.
Yeah.
Lost London Welsh, didn't they?
In the final, that's right, yeah. Yeah. No, I was sat at home watching that game. I think I hadn't quite signed for Pirates, but I knew. In fact, no, that's a tell a lie. I'd been told by Bristol I wasn't being kept on, so I was watching them in the back of my mind cheering Pirates on. Unknowing at the time, there was no communications from Pirates or myself about moving there, so it was just a case of being a bit spiteful, to be honest, which was uncharacteristic. but yeah, that was a hell of a game. I can remember watching that on TV watching Bristol go down to Pirates and lose, which has been a bit of a bogey ground, to be honest, for Bristol. The 3 years that I was down there, I think we played I think we played them twice at the Mene because we played them three times, I think, yeah, and beat them every time. So it's a bit of a bogey ground, that, for Bristol. I'm sure they won't want to be going down there.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, because of all the rugby I watch, you know, the Six Nations, European Cups, so on and so forth, I think the games which are probably the most exciting, they're well up there, are those Championship playoffs. I think they're absolutely brilliant, and it's a shame that they've gone. I mean, I understand why they have gone. They needed to go, but they were awesome.
Oh, yeah, to be honest, the only one I actually played in was the Bristol Exeter final. I sat on the bench on the first leg and came off in the second leg once the game was dead.
We
fell out of it that game. But I can just, again, I was 18, 19. The expectation that I was going to go and play in the Premiership with Bristol was not really there. It wasn't going to happen. So it was just, all I remember feeling, not me personally, but around the squad, was just absolute nerves. They were dreading every second of it, I think. Because everybody knew what was on the line. The expectations were that Bristol would go up. I think we'd absolutely walked the league, although there were a few, obviously, dodgy performances in games. But we were top and flying, and the boys beat London Welsh in the semi-final, which was a one-off game at the time.
Yeah.
So, I don't really remember much about that time. It was a while ago, but I do remember just the absolute dread and nerves that were around the squad, knowing that, you know, it was a do or die, and I think the first game finished 9-6 or something
like
that.
That's right, yeah, because Steno kicked all the points.
Yeah, that's right, and it was a pretty wet game down at their place, and 9-6, you're thinking, oh, this is all right, we'll come up to Bristol, and we'll sort of do a job. There's only 3 points, you're not going to base your gaining 3 points. It might be a bit different if you're sort of 13 behind, but yeah, obviously it didn't work out that way, and Gareth Steenson kicked Exeter through to the final, and you know, when you talk back to guys that were at Exeter at the time and you hear about how they planned their season, it sort of makes sense that they peaked at the right time, the way that they did everything, and obviously gone from strength to strength and shown what a good club they are since then.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, I don't think we'll ever see another player like Gareth Steenson, who has won both the Championship and the Premiership with the same club in the same stretch.
Yeah, it's fair play to him. But it just goes to show what a good sort of club environment Exeter have, that they keep guys, you know, I think Phil Dolman's another player who played for them down in the Championship, and you know, he's still playing pretty much week in, week out down there. So they're a club that, you know, respect their players and look after their players, and I guess offer them good money to stay there, but I'm sure the players would stay regardless.
Yeah, and doesn't it just kind of go back to what we started with, which is, opportunity is just as important as talent. Otherwise, no one would be talking about Gareth Steenson. It might never have happened.
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't know too much about Gareth's history and where he came from. I know he's obviously
we might be doing him a disservice there. You know, he might have up sticks and gone to Stafford on sale or something.
but he obviously played in the Championship for at least a season and had to dig it out. And that was before Exeter had the expectations that they obviously have now. They were just the up-and-coming club when Bristol and Exeter are down fighting out in the Championship. I think at Bristol, when they were in the Prem the year before and played them in pre-season, Exeter actually beat them in that pre-season game. So you sort of had the rumblings that there was something going on down there when they were getting this squad together, but you know, you didn't realise how good a squad it was, and Gareth Steenson was obviously an integral part of that winning culture that they sort of made down there, and he's obviously led it on since then, which is fair play to him, because
now,
to be at one club for that amount of time and to win what he's won is very impressive.
Well, hang on. During that final, just so I've got this right, you were on the bench. You were, what, 19, something like that?
19, yeah.
Okay. So, for you, I guess you were thinking, well, I'm going to get back there at some point anyway. Do you remember what the reaction was to the guys who were, like, you know, mid-20s, 30s? Because for them, it must have been a gut punch.
To be honest, I don't really remember. I remember nobody really knew what was going to happen next, which was that Bristol were going to lose a lot of their players because they'd obviously, I think things were in players' contracts that if they didn't go up, they could be released, etc. So that following season was pretty grim. A lot of guys senior squad members took 50% pay cuts. So obviously, I don't know if there was a little bit of that in some guys' minds, but certainly walking into the change room, it was like, literally like someone had just been shot dead. It was horrible, and that will stick with me for a long time. I don't really remember what was said after the game or anything like that, but I do remember walking into the change room and just looking at some of the older guys' faces and obviously the absolute the emotions of just losing essentially what was a cup final, was the biggest game of a lot of players' careers.
And
it dawned that we'd have to spend another, well, not me personally, but the group would have to spend another season in the Championship, which is, as everybody knows, not the...
it's a grind, isn't it?
...to be in, but, you know, it is what it is. But it was horrible time. And what followed the following season, where guys had to take pay cuts and a lot of guys left to join other teams, it was a pretty dark sort of 6 months following that defeat.
Was there any gallows humour? Did anyone sort of break the ice with a little wisecrack or some such thing, just to lift the spirits a bit?
I don't think you could. I think you'd probably have been smacked if you even tried.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, it almost sounds a bit drastic, but genuinely livelihoods were on the line in that game. And I'm sure there were a few guys, not that I know, but I'm sure there were a few lads that left after that because they didn't get promoted and contracts weren't renewed. Whereas if they'd got promoted, they might have been offered something to stay there. So, yeah, it was a pretty gutting time. I think stuff off the pitch had been set up for big celebrations, but obviously they weren't to be in. We had to watch all the Exeter fans running onto the pitch and lifting their players up for what was, in the end, pretty well-deserved promotion, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think history proves that now with where Exeter are.
Yeah, definitely. They've done it the right way. They built their stadium. They got their squad. They took their time. They planned the Championship out very well. From what I hear, they had a mini pre-season over Christmas, which, you know, you'd have to be a history buff, but I think they lost 3 or 4 games over that Christmas period. But they knew they were going to, and they had it planned out that they'd hit the ground running come the playoffs at the end of the season, and that was what happened in the end, and fair play to them. I think Bristol made the mistake, similar to sort of as we were speaking about earlier, about picking the same team. They had a few older guys that they sort of churned out every week. Winning the league, coming top, didn't matter in the end. So I think the mistake was made by making sure that they came top, and what they ended up doing was burning out a lot of players that they would have needed game in the final stages, and unfortunately those guys seem to have just been burnt out a little bit.
Yeah, well, and when they came to the Premiership, I'm sure they had the biggest squad in the league. I mean, that doesn't mean the best squad in the league, it just means, you know, they had numbers, and they did. I'm pretty sure that's correct. But
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I remember when I was first sort of part-time at Bristol in the Prem, they come the end of this, or near the end of the season, when they were fighting out in relegation, they literally split the squad up into two, and they had essentially the guys that they were going to use for the Prem games, and split the other guys up that they weren't even going to look at for selection. And that group, we sort of did our own training sessions, so they had enough numbers to split the team into two easily. So I wouldn't be surprised if they definitely did have the biggest squad in the league that year.
That's some fascinating insight. I had no idea about that.
Yeah. I mean, it was more so sort of the younger guys, but still guys, local boys as well, which I'm sure would give 110% to have kept Bristol in the league. But at the time, they split the squad into two, and that, you know, you had your first teamers and the guys that they well, I guess it was almost like a 30-man squad where they had their players that they were going to back to keep them in the league, and the rest of us, obviously, at that time, I was just a dream to play for Bristol. So I didn't really understand the politics, but looking back on it, I'm sure there were a lot of angry and upset about how they were looked after.
Yeah. Well, how about yourself then? Because like you were in the Championship for a long time. Did at any point it feel to you like maybe you're not going to get to that Premiership level?
My first year when I first moved down there, I felt like I'd gone from Bristol that were obviously Premiership contenders or promotion contenders. And Pirates were obviously doing really well in the season leading up to my arrival, getting to the semi-finals and finals of the Championship. But it was always apparent that they were never going to get promoted because of their facilities and stuff like that, and obviously having nothing in Cornwall that could get them into the Premiership like what Welsh did with Oxford. So at that time, I felt like it was a step backwards, but in hindsight, it definitely wasn't. It was what I needed to develop. And then that first year was just a year to sort of get in the team, and it was only a one-year contract, so even then I was scrapping it out to try and make sure that I got another year at the end of that.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that second year, my second year, Worcester showed an interest, but it hadn't materialised. I'd come up to see Dean Ryan and Carl Hogg and spoke with them, but they'd gone with a couple of other second rows. I think it was Dan Sanderson, the ex-Rotherham second row.
Yeah.
My third season, they'd come back to me and offered me a contract and bought me out of my contract down at Pirates. And that was that. So yeah, it was my first year. Obviously, there was no interest. Second year, Worcester shown an interest. So all of a sudden, I'm thinking, well, hang on, mate, there's something there. They've seen me do something well. So I just need to carry on doing what I'm doing. And another year in the Championship of developing myself and physically getting myself into good shape. That if something Premiership came along, I was ready to go. And fortunately enough, that's what happened.
So. A couple of lads I've interviewed in the past are asking me, what was your experience of your first Premiership game like? And a couple of them said the same thing, which I think is really interesting. They said, not fast, but they described it as heavy. Everyone seems heavier, like moving rucks is heavier. Just everything is just a little bit, it takes a little bit more strength.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree, to be honest. I'd say this, from what I remember, this is 4 years ago now, but from what I remember of the Championship, it's not, believe it or not, that much more physical. Mm. If I was speaking to a guy that was looking to sign for a Prem club from the Championship, I'd say to him, it's not that much more physical. What it is relentless. So it's that physicality for 80 minutes as opposed to for 60 minutes that you might get in the Championship because, your conditioning is not quite the same level, so teams drop off in the last sort of 20-15 minutes. Yeah. Whereas in the Premiership, it's relentless. The subs that come on are just as big as the ones that go off. And I'd say the game is a little bit quicker. Maybe the Championship's a bit more frantic because of that conditioning element. Guys are tiring, so you get the quicker guys can exploit a bit more space, whereas in the Prem, everyone's sort of relatively fit and can last 80 minutes if needs be. And obviously, teams have tactics to try and no opposition wingers and the nippy ones come those last 5-10 minutes of game. So, yeah, I wouldn't disagree, to be honest. It was a bit of a shock. It was a Friday night game, which I love anyway because the atmosphere seems to be a bit different on a Friday. I don't know what it is. It just has that bit more buzz about it.
Definitely does.
And it was at home as well, which, made a huge difference. And it was that Northampton game where Tom Heathcote kicked the last-minute drop goal. So I remember that game. I think I've made 20-odd tackles, which is ridiculous. I've never made that before. Yeah. So I remember being absolutely knackered come full time. But I think it was Kieran Brooks ran into me at one point and my sort of back just shuddered. And at that point realised that it is probably a little bit more physical than Championship, but not anything drastic. But it's just continuous. It just comes and it comes. And that year, the Northampton team were just rolling around the corner and it kept coming, it kept coming, it kept coming. And I think that was sort of a bit of a metaphor for the rest of the season as well.
Yeah, and Kieran Brooks is a massive man. Actually, I mean, if you're going to pick someone in the in the Premiership as a prototypical Premiership player, that might be it.
Yeah, that was a welcome to the Prem for me, and something I won't forget. Having a guy like that running down my channel.
Now this is a bit of a weird question, right? But you know, when you step up a level, either as an 18-year-old going to Bristol or, you know, maybe going into Worcester starting that game, have you ever been intimidated?
Intimidating game. Carl Hogg, our head coach, I was calling the lineups that day, so I was a bit nervous anyway, but Hoggy had made quite a big deal in the week leading up about Christian Day, the Northampton second row.
Yeah.
Knowing his line out experience and his line out calling ability and everything, and it was probably the most nervous I've ever been in the game, because it was my Prem debut, it was my Worcester debut. I'm playing against an experienced second row who knows his way around the line out. It's probably watched my last 10 lineouts for Pirates, probably watched the whole of pre-season's lineouts for Worcester, and I just remember absolutely petrified of even trying to call them out. They went well on the day. I think we lost one on the day, probably an overthrow, never the caller's fault. So it went pretty well, but yeah, that was the most nervous I've ever been, and yeah, since then I've sort of been all right. I think I've 4 years is obviously not that long for most Premiership players, but for me,
I think, you know, that's probably not far off the average Premiership career when you look at it across the league.
Yeah, maybe. I think I'm just over 50 games, maybe approaching 60. I guess I've amounted a decent amount of experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely that first game that's made me the most nervous in any game I've ever played for Worcester. It was just, I felt like a little kid coming up against an international on that day. Just the way the week went, Christian was being bigged up somewhat wicked by our coach. I'm surprised he didn't try and sign him. But it went well. And since then, I've sort of felt a little bit more comfortable in this league. I've obviously played against people like Mario Toji and George Cruz. George Cruz is probably the hardest guy to have gone against in a line-out, certainly calling line-outs against him. He reads him very well. So I felt all right in those sort of games. So it's not been too bad, to be honest. Yeah.
So is the line-out that, you know, your point of pride?
Yeah, I've always been a line-out caller. This year's been a little bit different. I've had to take a backward step. Some of the games I've played in, I've not been the line-out caller, which has been a bit frustrating, because that's the one thing that I sort of pride myself on, certainly off the pitch in terms of analysis. That would be the one thing that I'll definitely sit in front of the laptop or computer and go through opposition line-outs. And often I'll be involved in the meetings for line-outs for the weekend, even if I'm not calling them. So I've always sort of prided myself on that, and I enjoy it, to be honest. It's like a game of chess.
It is, isn't it? It's brilliant.
It is. It sounds, for anyone who doesn't know anything about line-outs, you think I'm an idiot, but it is exciting, you know. Especially when you're going to an international and you're sort of trying to prove what goes on around the pitch. I suppose a lot of people can do similar things around the pitch, but the line-outs is where you sort of, the second rows stand apart, I think. So if you're a good line-out caller, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, I do some, because I think I'm with you here. I love line-outs. I'm not particularly good at line-outs, but I just love line-outs. I do love the strategy around them. I do wonder, though, like, do rugby players and, you know, the rugby community in general, do we spend too much time looking at lineouts and these set pieces? Because they're not exactly, you know, most of the game. Most of it is running around hitting rucks and, you know, open field stuff.
Yeah, definitely. For
you
example,
just go down the rabbit hole.
This week we played Exeter. I don't know how many lineouts they gave us in the game, but we worked out something like they only give you 8 lineouts. They just don't kick the ball out.
Is that right?
So 8 lineouts we did. 160 line-out jumps that week, bearing in mind we trained 2 days. So for 8 line-outs, we did 80 line-outs a day.
That's staggering. What?
That's not unusual. So again, you're going back to the supporters and supporters sort of piping up and stuff. You sort of read their comments about how shambolic our line-outs might have been on this weekend or that weekend, and you think, well, actually, there's a lot that can go wrong in a line-out.
Yeah, there is.
Try and iron out, but sometimes a gust of wind will take the ball not straight. Well, that's a line out loss. That it can be helped in some ways, but it's also a bit of a freak accident. But yeah, we certainly put the hours in. It was 160 line outs that we put in 2 days. And like I said, that's not unusual. That's pretty norm for us, which is something that we're trying to bring down. Unfortunately, for every mistake you make, you have to do that line out again, because, you know, hookers need timings, jumpers, line out callers need to know that the hooker knows that call. So the moment somebody messes up, you've got to do that line out again, and all of a sudden, 160 line outs later, you've got yourself prepped for 8 line outs on the weekend. So, yeah, I do think we probably do a little bit too much. And having sat in a lot of line out meetings, you go through games and games and hours worth of analysis, looking at line outs. And if this guy does this, then we can do that. And if this guy does this, then we can do that. And then come the weekend, that guy's not playing.
Yeah.
Again, your line out research has sort of gone down the drain a little bit.
Yeah, it is a difficult one, particularly with defence, because you can prepare to the nth degree and they might just do something completely different. I heard that a few seasons ago, Wasps were just reinventing their lineouts for every third of the season. So complete new calls, completely new everything, because they thought so many people were going to be, it might have been more than 3 years ago. I mean, like 5 years ago, because they thought, well, there's so much analysis out there, we'll just change everything completely.
Yeah, that's something that we've sort of flirted with a little bit. The cameras now, they're so, like, obviously when TV are on, there's 3 or 4 different angles. The rest microphones can pick up whatever call you're making in the line out, and sometimes it's easy to put 2 and 2 together and work it out. So yeah, I think there is a need for it to be changed every now and again. The problem is with that is that changing your structure, changing your calls, means that you need to learn them all over again. And anyone who's played rugby yourself, it's a language. I could sit down with a Worcester player and talk in absolute jargon to anybody else. They wouldn't understand a word I'm saying, but everything that I'm saying is clear as day to the other guy because of the language used. Well, if you've got to reinvent that language every 6 months or 4 months, sometimes it can lead to a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, and I think another thing... Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because I don't think people appreciate how much effort goes into this. There's a couple of academy lads playing up at Sale Sharks, and I know those lads will go down to the Sale FC ground and throw 100 balls, come rain, wind or shine, and they do that every day.
Yeah, we're not too different down here, to be honest. It's a bit nicer down here, so we don't have the rain, wind or shine. Yeah. A bit more time down there. It's difficult because... I've read a few books and everyone says, it's 10,000 hours of this and it's perfect practice. I don't think there's any such thing as perfect practice. And sometimes it's easy for a hooker to throw on a target that's not moving when you've got no wind, might be inside, for example, or down here. The best way for hookers to throw, I think, is just going live, when guys are jumping. The problem you have then is if you're a jumper doing 180 jumps a week, at some point something's going to give, whether it's your back or your knees. Certainly we've got Methan Davis, our scrum coach, who also helps with the hookers down here at Worcester, and they have timetabled sessions. I think it's normally on a Tuesday at the end of the day or a Wednesday, where they'll do extra line out throwing and he works with them. They've all got different techniques. They all like to throw slightly differently. You've got some guys who like to throw with a bit more shape, so they'll put a bit more lob on it. You've got other guys who like to throw hard and fast. So, you've got to work your line out menu on the weekend around that as well, which is a bit challenging. It can be anyway.
So how much leeway do you guys as players have in deciding what lineouts you're going to run?
At the start of the season down here at Worcester, we pretty much ran it with Rory, our head coach. Unfortunately, things didn't go to plan. So there were a few changes in terms of how our line out went or worked. Which seemed to have made a bit of a difference. Rory took on a few more of the line-out calls himself, a bit of the analysis, and he would often invite us into his office, and we would go through his menu, and then we'd also chip in with anything that we've seen. So it's probably almost like a 60-40, Rory being the 60, the line-out callers. I think there's 3 or 4 of us that go in now that will sit down and come up with the rest of it. We'd have all sort of sat down in front of the laptops or whatever and gone for opposition lineouts. And again, it sometimes depends on who's playing on the weekend. Guys have different ways of calling. Guys have different preferences. You might be a good on-the-spot jumper, so prefer to have a call that's on the spot as opposed to shooting forward. Or you might have a hooker that prefers to hit you shooting forward as opposed to hitting you on a lob ball. So you've got to take that into consideration. And one thing that we've learned over the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks is conditions and personnel as well. On the weekend a couple of weeks ago, we had a young Isaac Miller coming off the bench who hadn't really played any Premiership rugby all season, but came off the bench after, I think it was 20 minutes against Newcastle, and Callum Green, the experienced lock up there, sort of took our line out apart a little bit in many ways, and so you've got to take that into consideration as well. Who's the backup, and what's their experience, and then can we sort of mould some calls around them so when they come on we get them in the game, and a few simple calls often the front ball, and get them, ease them in.
So when you're defending a line out, this is nerdy now, do you have any tells that you look for from opposition jumpers to know when you think they're going to go?
You can do, but it's difficult to implement that into your like defensive system, because obviously that guy might not be playing on the weekend.
Yeah.
The same thing, the team comes out later on in the week, that you know whether or not you can use that, and by that time it's normally a bit too late. You want the team tend to want to do a bit more defensive lineouts later on in the week. But yeah, there are certain the way that people stand can sometimes be a bit of a giveaway. As to where they're going to go, won't give away any of our trade secrets just yet. We're in a bit of a relegation scrap. We need all the secrets we can keep. But yeah, there's certain teams that have a certain way of calling the lineup, or certain players, sorry, that have a certain way of standing in the lineup that can maybe give away where it's going to go. But ultimately, you never really know where it's going. You sort of just try and mark a zone and hope that you pick the right zone.
Now, you don't need to give away any trade secrets here. I don't even want any names. But can you give me an example, maybe, of when you have come up against an opposition guy and you just know what he is doing and why you knew what he was doing? I mean, you can give me names, feel free. Well, but
I won't be giving names. Unfortunately, we've still got this team to come, so I can't. But there's one team where their front guy will stand just out the line out a little bit, and you can sort of read that he's going to shoot, or the guy behind him is going to shoot in front of him. Now there's two things that will happen. He'll either turn and lift him from behind, or he'll turn and lift the guy that is behind that guy. So you can sort of see that he's slightly stood out the line out, and something's going to happen. And by sort of just doing your analysis, you understand that there's probably two outcomes. So you need to try and mark both spots, which is what we'll have a little guy in the middle who pivots. You can either turn in front or turn behind and sort of just mirror what they do. But yeah, there's that sort of thing. And sometimes line out callers in particular, if they're calling to themselves, they'll face straight onto the hooker. When it's not to them, they'll maybe be a little bit more side on because they need to do a dummy lift or a dummy jump or I don't think I'm giving too much away there, but there's certainly some teams and some players and some movements. I think it's probably the big one. It's the movement that you can see happening before it does.
Now, you've obviously accumulated all this knowledge through a lifetime of rugby, but is there anyone that stands out who's given you really good tips on this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think Roy Winters, when I was down at Bristol, I don't know if it was just me, but he seemed to take me under his wing a little bit. And it was at that time where I was sort of beginning to call the line out in A-League games. I was beginning to call the line out. I was calling the line out a lot for the team I was dual reg with. So that was obviously something that they were looking at developing was my line out calling. And he was in charge of the first team line out. And I would often sit down with him at analysis and just watch how he sort of jotted down all the movements and how he would sort of collate them together and come up with a plan on how that week they were going to defend or what movements they were going to defend, because you soon realise you can't defend everything. Teams, once they know you might be a mirror defence, once they see how you mirror, that'll be it. You're just throwing six, seven movements and then all of a sudden you're bumping into each other. So he was good for that, and he took the time out to sit down with me and sort of explain his workings out and help me with how I was going to develop. And I would often be the guy calling opposition lineouts against the first team, in particular that first championship year. He was probably the best one that I've worked with in that regard, definitely. He was really good.
Awesome. Just bringing it to the present day then.
Yeah.
You guys are doing better than last year. I think that's actually statistically true. I think you've got more points. But it does feel like the Premiership this year is also a lot better than it was last year. There's no two ways about that. Is there a sense of nervousness around the squad? Or are you all basically coming in and you're pretty buoyant because, you know, you are doing better than, you know, it is a better team, I'd say, than last year's version of Worcester.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I think this is the best squad that I've been involved in. You know, we spoke earlier about first choice, second choice, third choice, but I think there's a genuine call for your first, second and third choice in every position to be good enough for the Premiership, which maybe hasn't been the case in the last few years, where I think last year we only had two senior loose heads, whereas this year we've got three. So straight away, you're stronger in that position. But yeah, I don't know if there's nervousness. We sort of laugh and joke that the coaches should just leave it to the players. We've been here before, 3 years and
yeah,
experience in doing the Great Escape. So it's a bit, you know, a little bit of a joke, but I don't think there is nervousness, no. And I think it's because there's so much left of the season. And even though if you look at the table, you're going to say it's a two-horse race, which it may be, but I think...
I don't think it is. I think there's four teams involved now.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're sort of looking at as a positive, really. Whereas in previous years, it's been a two-horse race. It's been London Irish and Worcester, or it's been Bristol and Worcester, and you're scrapping out amongst each other, whereas at the moment, you're scrapping it out amongst four of you, so it doesn't seem like it's... I don't know, it feels different. It just doesn't seem like it's as much of a concern this season as it has been in previous years.
Yeah.
Because you know that you could play well and other teams play badly, and all of a sudden it's them that's scrapping out down at the bottom as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a close season that a couple of wins either way and you're out of danger, but on the other hand, a couple of wins for Newcastle, you know, they're going to be putting a lot of pressure on you boys. Conversely, I think Tigers are right in the mix, and Bristol could be right in the mix.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at Sale, I think Sale, a few weeks back, maybe 5 weeks back, were looking in a bit of trouble as well.
Yeah, well, Sale were bottom of the table at one point.
And now you look at them, they've shot up. I think Harlequins had a dodgy patch at one point where you're thinking... So I think at the start of this, well, halfway through the season, it was a two-horse race at the top, and then maybe Gloucester were the only other team that you think aren't going to get pulled into anything dodgy. Whereas now I think the league split up into sort of thirds again. You've got your top four, your middle four, and then you've got maybe sort of four or five at the bottom that are scrapping out. But realistically, that middle block at the moment look like they're going to be safe and they're playing well enough to stay up. But the rest of us, yeah, we're all in it. And like you said, if Newcastle, who have just won two on the bounce, continue to play the way they are and grinding out results, then, you know, other teams like ourselves are going to get sucked into it. So yeah, it's definitely the most competitive league. Like last year, you had your top two, and then you had your next eight, and then you had your bottom two. It was whereas this year, yeah, it's sort of real scrappy at the moment, and I think you can probably see that in results. There's some tight games because teams know how important bonus point or losing bonus points are, especially at this stage of the season where you're running out of games a little bit.
Yeah, I've never seen a Premiership like this one where everyone has got such complete team, such a settled team, and, you know, so many good players. I mean, Newcastle go down, they're going to go down with a handful of internationals. If it happens to you again, you've got a handful of internationals. You've got England's starting centre.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah. So it's weird, and obviously Leicester historically have always been that top four team. So to have them down here is a bit of a shock. And I'm sure that might be one of the reasons why closing the league's been mentioned, because a team like Leicester going down would be just...
not going to happen.
Would it, you know, or a Bath with their stadium not being fit to come back up as well. So I'm sure if one of those big teams start to really slide down the league and genuinely, you know, really do look like they might be struggling to stay in the league, then you might be looking at a closing Premiership.
I mean, I would like ring fencing. But I do appreciate it would come at the expense of the drama, which, you know, for you is not great, but for me as a spectator, it's wonderful.
It does add a bit of spice. It makes games competitive. If this league was closed off and you got these four teams down at the bottom, realistically, what are you playing for? You're not playing for much. You're not going to win the league. You're probably not going to get in the top six for the main European competition. So it certainly keeps all the fixtures competitive, especially when it's so close. Obviously, if there was a team down at the bottom, like London Welsh, for example, a few years back, that couldn't get a win, then it makes it a bit of a mockery. But when it's this competitive, it certainly shows just how good this Premiership League is.
Yeah, completely agree. Right, well, I'll leave you with one last question. Give me a prediction of where you're going to finish. And if you want to find more of your fiery contributions on Twitter, where do we find that?
Oh, that's a good point, actually. I've had to change my... partner told me I needed to change my my Twitter because it was too childish, and now I've had to change to Darren Barry 90. Yeah, I've been a bit quiet the last few weeks, but I'm sure as frustrations boil over, there may be a few more tweets aimed at, I don't know, supporters or somebody. Predictions? Do you know? I generally don't know. We could finish bottom, I think, or we could finish ninth. It is that sort of league, as we mentioned, how tight it is at the moment. Teams like Leicester, if they continue to slide down the league, there's always hope that we can get a few good wins at home and pick up some decent results away from home as well. So I'll go with 10th, which at the start of the season we were aiming for a top six, so it'd be a bit of a disappointment, but the way the league is at the moment, I think boys would be pretty happy with 10th.
Excellent. Darren, absolutely loved having you on. We're going to have to do it again sometime.
Yes, please. No worries. Good. Thank you.
Darren, thank you very much for that. That's absolutely...
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.